Hebrews chapter 6. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on.
Hey, friend, welcome back here to the Semi-Seminary, and I'm Pastor Jim, and yeah, I'm not just a famous podcaster. I'm also pastor of a small-town church. And what you're joining with us tonight is our Wednesday night Bible study. Tonight, we're going to look at the parable of the prodigal son. Now, listen, you've heard it 100 times. The wayward rebel, the loyal rule follower, one runs, one resents, and every preacher draws the map. Don't be like him, be like him. But here's the truth. Jesus wasn't talking about either one of them. He was aiming at the people who thought they had already had it figured out. He was talking to the grumblers, the one who couldn't stomach mercy being served to the wrong folks. And if you're listening to this thinking, well, that's not me, you might want to hold on. Because this parable doesn't just reveal grace, it exposes pride. And sometimes the most lost person in the story never even left home. If this kind of hard gospel wrapped in storytelling hits you just right, do me a favor. Like, share, subscribe, tell somebody else who's been sitting outside the party. Let's dig in. I'll see you on the other side. Are we ready, Wayne? So, parables part 4. And I think what we're going to find as we continue to look at these parables that many of the details that we were taught about these stories as kids, we're going to find that we had wrong and that the lessons being taught are actually different than the way that we thought. I think this story is just one of those. We're doing the parable of the prodigal son tonight, and this story is not about the younger son. In fact, this parable isn't about the elder son either. It's about neither of them. Parable actually is a lesson on God's grace. So, you've been here all day, dust settling on your shoes, grit creeping between your toes, the sun's slipping lower, but the crowd still presses in. You'd think hunger or weakness would scatter them, but not when he's speaking. There's something about his voice that makes the stomach grow quiet. Something about his stories pulls you in deeper than the ache in your legs. You glance around at the faces. On one side, the ones who can't usually get this close. Tax collectors with shifty reputations. Women whispered about. Men with pasts so heavy they rarely lift their eyes. But tonight they lean in as though the words themselves are bread. On the other side, arms folded, jaws set, Pharisees, scribes, synagogue leaders. You can feel their tension before you ever even hear their grumbling. They don't like the company he keeps. And they hate that holiness smells like lamb fat and cheap wine set at a sinner's table. That's the stage. Hungry ones near, self-righteous ones grumbling, and right in the middle, Jesus. And he doesn't back down, he doesn't scold, he doesn't retreat. He opens his mouth and he tells a story. So, let the ancient sound wash over you. Hear not just with your ears, but with the deep place where memory and spirit meet. Luke chapter 15, verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him. And the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he told them this parable. And he said, "There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to the father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and took a journey into the far country. There, he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out of one of the citizens of that country, sent him into the field to feed the pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is now found.' And they began to celebrate. Now, the older son was in the field. And as he came and drew near the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he," that's the older brother, "was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but as he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your commands. Yet you never gave me one young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you're always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is now alive. He was lost and is found.' The word is spoken. Now it lingers, asking to be lived." You actually hear it before you see it. Not loud, not shouted, low and steady. A grumble, faintly rumbling like distant thunder. You glance to your left, and there they are, the Pharisees, the scribes, lips moving, heads leaning close to whisper to one another. You don't need to ask what they're saying. You can feel it. Disapproval, disgust. Their arms are crossed, their eyes narrowed, their voices carry a single word: grumble. Now, we get this account from the gospel according to Luke. Luke tells you exactly how to name that sound: diagungazo. Say it with me under your breath: diagungazo. It feels like the word itself. In fact, in Greek, it's an onomatopoeia. A growl in the throat, a complaint rolling low. It isn't just one man shaking his head in disapproval. It is a whole group grumbling together, letting their discontent buzz in the air. And remember, we're in that crowd. If you've heard the scriptures at any point read in the synagogue in your life, you know this sound already. Because the Greek Old Testament, something called the Septuagint, used this very word to describe your ancestors when they were in the wilderness. Now, the Septuagint isn't just any old translation of the Hebrew Bible. It is the scriptures in Greek. It is the version that Jews in Jesus' day, as well as most of the early church of Christians, read aloud. It's the bridge between Hebrew memory and Greek storytelling. And it matters here because when Luke writes diagongazo, he's not just describing complaint. He's dragging the wilderness into the street right where Jesus stands. Close your eyes. Suddenly, you're not in Galilee anymore. You're standing in the desert. Your tongue cracked with thirst. Your stomach twisted in hunger. You've just passed through the Red Sea. Your sandals, your cloak are still damp from freedom. Pharaoh's army is gone, swallowed up whole. And yet this sound rises from your own throat. Diagongazo, grumbling, complaining. You may remember Exodus 16. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled, diagongazo, against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, where we sat by meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly of hunger. Can you hear it? Even with manna on the ground, they still grumble. Even with water gushing from the rock, still grumble. God's grace raining down on them and God's people murmuring back. Now we're back in Galilee, different desert, same sound. Jesus is welcoming sinners, feeding them with his presence. And the Pharisees stand on the edges, lips curled, grumbling the wilderness word, diagongazo. And here's what Luke wants you to feel. That word is not a throwaway. That word is not an accident. In the first century, these stories were carried very carefully, word for word, like precious cargo. The eyewitnesses, that's how Luke got his account, the eyewitnesses telling and retelling the moment that we're talking about had other Greek verbs that they could have chosen and used. But they reached for this one, the wilderness word, so that you would hear that echo. So that you would know that when the Pharisees grumbled, they were standing in the exact same posture as their ancestors who doubted in God's provision. This is why the Septuagint is such a gift to us, because it lets us lay Greek over Greek, Luke's verb over Exodus's verb, and watch the words line up. The lexicon of the New Testament gets colored in by the palette of the Old Testament. The grumble here used in Luke carries the dust of the Sinai on it. And watch how the parable itself will carry that sound to the very end. The elder brother, standing outside the feast, arms crossed, jaw tight, his lips will shape the same complaint. Diagongazo. The story begins with a grumble and it ends with a grumble. The wilderness is not behind you, it's here. And it is alive in every grumble that rises when grace somehow offends your sense of fairness. So then the question presses in. When grace sets the table, when forgiveness smells like roasted calf and music shakes the walls, what sound will come out of your mouth? Will it be a song of joy? Or will it be that same old wilderness grumble? The boy, the younger son, had rehearsed his speech 100 times on the road home. Dirt covering him from head to toe. Shame bowing his shoulders. The only words that he can imagine, I have sinned. I am no longer worthy. treat me as a servant. That's the script he writes for himself. But the father won't even let him finish it. While the boy is still a long ways away, far off, scripture says, the old man sees him, feels compassion, and runs. Also know, fathers didn't run in this world. Running for an adult male with the tunics was considered beneath their dignity. But this one gathers up his robes and sprints down the road. He embraces his filthy son, kisses him, and cuts his confession off mid-sentence. Everything the crowd expects, the father refuses. Expected a beating, given a kiss. Expected a slave's lot in life, a servant contract. Given a robe, a ring, sandals, food. Expected slow earning back of trust. Given instant restoration to sonship. It is grace that doesn't wait for permission. It is reconciliation that ignores decorum. It is a joy that explodes in music and dancing before the neighbors can even stop gasping and clutching the pearls. And here's what you must see. To the sinners in the crowd, this is a revelation. God's not wanting to scold you for your unworthiness. He runs out to meet you. To the Pharisees, it's a rebuke. And it's a comfort wrapped in one. The Father's honor is not diminished by welcoming in the sinner. His house does not somehow get smaller because another son has come home. The same reality of God's love is revealed to both audiences at once. Notice also the order of the father's reassurance to the elder son. He doesn't start with the bank accounts. He starts with his presence. To the elder son, he'll say, "Son, you've always been with me. And only then all that is mine is yours." Presence, then property. Communion, then calculation. And if we miss that order, I think we miss the heart of God. Let's look at him, the elder son, sweating from the fields, hears music, and his rage flares up. He's not going in. So the father comes out. Think of that. Just as he's run to meet the younger, now he steps outside for the elder. Two sons, two refusals, two humiliating journeys of the father. One onto the road, one out of the party. And don't miss it, that same wilderness word, diagungazo, hums here too. The elder's grumble mirrors the Pharisee's grumble. The wilderness complaint echoing through the generations. Both are being embraced by a grace that moves first. And this is where we need to see the double edge of the parable. Because Jesus is teaching to two audiences at once. To the sinners in the crowd, the story is pure hope. The father runs to meet you, robe and ring ready, no delay, no earning it back. Your shame cannot keep you out of his house. To the Pharisees, that same story is a mirror. The father comes out to you too. His covenant with you hasn't changed. Not one thing has been taken from you. The younger's welcome back is not at your loss. It's the father's freedom to love both sons. The same reality of God's love is shown to both sons, to both crowds, and it is wholly at the discretion of the father. Grace does not divide a finite pie. It overflows the table so that everyone can be called in. And some of us know what it's like to live that younger son's story. Ashamed, reckless, desperate for mercy. And others know the other son's resentment. Faithful, dutiful, quietly furious that grace could be given so freely to someone who hadn't earned it. And here Jesus said, God is not choosing between you. He's choosing for you, both of you, with a love that does not diminish when it's shared. Picture the crowd again, the tax collectors and the sinners breathing easier, the Pharisees shifting on their heels. Jesus isn't pitting one against the other. He's pulling both towards the Father. You may come home, he tells the sinners. You may come in, he tells the Pharisees. The only one who ends the story outside is the one who chooses to keep their arms folded. So ask yourself, where do your arms rest? Are they open like the Father's, or crossed like the elders? Have you learned to rejoice when someone else gets grace at your party? Isn't it almost wasteful the way the Father gives? The robe, the ring, the calf, the music, all for a son who had burned through his inheritance. From a human perspective, you could call it reckless. You could call it inefficient. You could call it wasteful. And you wouldn't be wrong if the Father were working with a limited supply. Think of the vineyard owner that we talked about, paying the last hour workers a full day's wage while looking at the dawn crew in the eye when they grumble and saying, do you begrudge my generosity? You can hear the elder brothers grumble in that question. You can hear the Pharisees grumble in that question too. The master is free to be generous. Grace does not require your consent. Let's stand again in the yard, listen to the soundtrack of this house. Inside, singing, laughter, the shuffle of sandals on packed earth, the thrum of a drum, neighbors clapping offbeat and not caring. Outside, the cicadas buzz, the night wind grits the teeth of the elder son, and between, the Father's voice, low and pleading. The same kindness that once sprinted down the road, now pausing in the doorway, begging pride to die and letting joy live. Wasteful, says the elder, because he thinks that calf was his. Wasteful, says the Pharisee, because he thinks his holiness will be cheapened by the Father's mercy. Wasteful, say we, when we forget that none of us hired the band or bought the wine. The Father owns the house. The Father fills the table. The Father is the one who says it is fitting to celebrate and be glad. Here's one more echo. The Father says, all that is mine is yours. And if you stand in that sentence long enough, you can feel a mystery open. The inheritance is not about a stockpile of money. It's about a relationship. The son's true wealth is the withness of the Father. You are always with me is the first treasure. All that is mine is yours is the second. Presence then property. God gives himself first. Everything else is wrapped around that gift. So here we stand at the edge of the party. Music drifting through the windows, the smell of roasted calf in the air, the Father's voice still echoing, it was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and he is found. And the question is not just for the Pharisees, not just for the elder brother. It is for you and for me. Will you walk inside? Will you lay down your grumble, your clenched jaw, your arms crossed tight across your chest? Or will you stay outside, grumbling while grace dances without you? Because here's the crystal truth, plain enough for midnight radio and Sunday morning both. Jesus is teaching two audiences at once and one God in both. To the sinners, he says, the Father runs to you. Stop rehearsing your unworthiness and let him wrap you in a robe you did not buy. To the Pharisees, at the same time, he says, the Father comes out for you too. Nothing has been taken from you. Your place at the table has never been in jeopardy. Do not let another's mercy feel like your loss. The same reality of the Father's love is poured out to both, never diminished, never divided, and always at his discretion. Grace is not a pie that shrinks when shared. It's a feast that multiplies when you decide to pick up your fork. So choose, not between sons, between postures, between grumbling and music, between counting and rejoicing, between staying outside, stepping into the light that leaks through the cracks of that door, the Father holds open with his very own body. Lift your head, hear the drum, smell the feast, feel the hand of the Father on your shoulder. Father's free in his love. He does not ask the Pharisees' permission to forgive the sinner. He does not ask the sinner's permission to bless the faithful. His love is wholly his to give, and he gives it in abundance. That is what Jesus wanted that crowd to see. And that's what he wants you to see too. Grace is already poured out, friends. The party has already begun. The only question left is, will you join in the song or grumble? Amen. Amen. Thanks, guys. You know, maybe the most haunting thing about this parable is that the elder brother never walks in. Jesus leaves it open. He doesn't tell us if the brother forgives or even listens, just silence. Father's invitation hanging in the air like smoke from a sacrifice. And maybe that's because the story ain't finished. Maybe it's your turn. You see, the elder brother obeyed every rule but missed the father's heart. He stayed near the house but far from joy. And if we're honest, there's a little bit of elder brother in all of us. We want grace for ourselves but justice for them. We want celebration when we come back but punishment when they do. We love the idea of God's mercy until he gives it to someone we don't think deserves it. Then we hear the Spirit whisper, "My child, you're always with me. All I have is yours." But we had to celebrate. He's dead and now he's alive. This is the gospel. God doesn't wait at the door. He runs down the road. He walks out of the party. He pleads with the proud. He forgives the grumblers. And he refuses to write anyone out of the story. So maybe it's time to stop folding your arms and start walking towards the music. If this stirred something in you, would you like, share, subscribe? Not for clicks, but because someone you love might be standing in the field, arms crossed, and they don't even know the feast has started. I'll see you next time.
Chapter 6. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on.